Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument this morning is Edelman Reyes against St. Xavier University. Ms. Pfeiffer.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sally Pfeiffer, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Sharon Edelman Reyes, who was an associate professor at St. Xavier University. Dr. Reyes worked in the School of Education at St. Xavier until her employment with St. Xavier was terminated as a result of being denied tenure. I'm here before you today to ask this court to reverse the grant of summary judgment and to remand this case for trial. Dr. Reyes' appeal contains two components of Judge Duryagian's decision. First, his treatment of the religious discrimination claim, and second, treatment of the tortious interference claim against the individual defendant, Beverly Gulley, who is the dean of the School of Education. The district court's decision to dismiss these claims was premised on a failure to acknowledge the genuine dispute over facts which were material to those issues and which make summary judgment inappropriate.
Ms. Pfeiffer,
Pfeiffer, that's
Pfeiffer,
fine.
Pfeiffer, thank you. I'm just a bit perplexed by your reading of Dr. Chalokwu's testimony. It seemed to me that at most he testified that he discussed the plaintiff's complaints with Ms. Gulley, but never seems to have hinted that the plaintiff's absences played any part in Ms. Gulley's decision to advise against tenure. So what I need for you to do is to help me understand how you came to that reading.
Sure. During his testimony, Dr. Chalokwu was asked whether or not he had any discussions with Dean Gulley about Dr. Reyes' absences or about her religious beliefs. Specifically, the question was, did you ever have any conversations with Dean Gulley about Dr. Reyes' complaints of discrimination, particularly as it related to her religion or her biracial relationship? Dr. Chalokwu testified that they did not have a discussion about a biracial relationship, but with respect to religion, he said they talked in general terms about her not being at a particular event.
Well, here's what he said in response to the question at one point. Right. Again, in general terms with specific reference to being absent. And then the question was, do you recall anything specific that Dean Gulley said about Dr. Reyes' absences? And he said, I don't recall. I mean, at no point does he seem to testify that Ms. Gulley told him that Dr. Reyes' religion played a part in her decision to recommend against tenure. He acknowledges that they talked about the complaints that she was being treated differently and that the conversations related in general terms to her being absent from certain events due to the Jewish hospital. But he also testified that he had no way of knowing how Dean Gulley felt about those absences. And he didn't recall anything specific that she ever said about the absences. So that's my problem here.
And I think that there is an inference that Dean Gulley took into account those absences when she drafted her negative recommendation letter, because in that negative recommendation letter, she specifically indicated that Dr. Reyes's service to the university was not what it was expected to be. And during her deposition, when I questioned her further on that issue, she testified that Dr. Reyes was not at the university as much as other faculty members. And I think there is a reasonable inference that can be drawn that because of her absences due to attending Jewish holidays, that played a role in Dean Gulley's negative recommendation.
But that begs the question about whether there's any evidence to support the inference that the absences were associated with attendance at religious events and religious holidays.
But
there isn't any testimony to support that, the general notion of absences as having contributed to the negative recommendation perhaps can be inferred but any link to religious holidays is absent.
But the absences were due to her attending religious holidays, and I think the inference
is,
came...
Is there evidence to support that?
In the record, yes.
From attributable to Dean Gulley?
Yes. She was aware that in earlier 2003, Dr. Reyes was absent from an event because she was celebrating Passover. And that was one that, and I think the inference can be made that when she spoke to Dr. Chiloku several months later and indicated that she was not going to be granting tenure, and that one of the reasons and that they had discussed the religious beliefs or her attendance at religious events, that there can be a reasonable link between her religious beliefs and the negative recommendation letter.
So there is an evidentiary link between the issue of the overall absences from university events and attendance at religious holidays, and that link is attributable to Dean Gulley, that she based her negative recommendation at least in part on those specific absences or the overall issue of absences?
I believe that there's evidence in the record that links it to absences. I don't know that it makes a difference whether it's absences in general because or specific to her religion.
Why
because
not?
Because the fact remains that absences, many of the absences that Dr. Reyes had, were linked to her attending religious events.
Is that established in the record?
It is.
That there were a sufficient number of absences attributable to religious holidays?
It
this is a religious discrimination claim, so there has
yes,
to be more than, you know, a few each year to make out a religious discrimination claim.
Well, in addition, Dean Gulley made a comment earlier on in Dr. Reyes' tenure with the university referring to Dr. Reyes as a liberal-oriented Jew, which in our view, although not determinative of direct evidence of discrimination, is a link which the court can use to support a conclusion that she was held animosity against Dr. Reyes because of her Jewish beliefs.
That was many years before the tenure decision in this case, wasn't it?
It was, but the fact that it was made many years beforehand does not necessarily mean that that it's evidence of non-discrimination. It's part of the link, which is what we are arguing in this case, is that you can't look at pieces of evidence in isolation. You have to look at the amalgamation of evidence. And I believe that the amalgamation of evidence in this case supports a conclusion that a reasonable jury could find that Dr. Reyes was discriminated against based on her religion, or that Dean Gulley had some other ulterior motive which would support the tortious interference claim.
Is there anywhere in the record that will tell us what percentage of the absences are directly related to the Jewish holidays?
There is not. At the summary,
by the way, speaking of the record, where in the record below did the defendants concede that a prima facie case could be made out by Dr. Edelman Reyes?
It's not anywhere in the record, but the fact remains that they didn't even set forth a prima facie case in their summary judgment brief or in reply, or even in their brief to this court. They simply jumped to the final issue, which was pretext. And it's our belief that that they conceded the existence of a prima facie case. And in fact, the district court in his decision indicated that the defendants had conceded the remaining elements of its prima facie case, but did not and would not consider the evidence that Dr. Reyes had offered to support her conclusion that Dr. Reyes and Dr. Falahi were in fact similarly situated.
It's not the defendant's burden to put on a prima facie case, though. It's your burden.
I understand that, but the fact that they jump to pretext without going through the analysis of saying there's no evidence that she's similarly situated, there's no evidence that she suffered an adverse employment action, in my view, is requires Dr. Reyes to go through, a mechanical element of her case. And, in fact, the fact remains that she offered sufficient evidence to support the prima facie case. She offered evidence that she is Jewish. Dr. Falahi is not. Both were employed in the School of Education. Both reported to the same supervisor. Both were promoted from assistant professor to associate professor at the same time. Both were recommended by the School of Education Rank and Tenure Committee to receive tenure, although Dr. Falahi's was with qualification. Dr. Reyes was not. Both had similar student evaluations, although Dr. Reyes evaluations overall were more favorable.
I realize I'm getting you into your rebuttal time, but the defendants, of course, have argued that the tortious interference claim is preempted by the Illinois Human Rights Act. Would you concede that the Illinois Human Rights Commission has exclusive jurisdiction over a claim of religious jurisdiction?
Discrimination. It does have exclusive jurisdiction over the issue of religious discrimination, but whether preemption applies turns on whether or not Dr. Reyes can establish the elements of the tortious interference claim without resort to the rights created by the Illinois Human Rights Act. She had a right to continued employment with the university. She had an expectation of continued employment with the university. That was interfered with, and I think the evidence in the case would allow a reasonable fact finder to conclude in the alternative that if it wasn't her religious beliefs that caused the denial of tenure, that instead it was Dean Gulley's personal animosity toward Dr. Reyes, which is supported in the record.
Thank you.
And the result.
Mr. McNeil.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Don McNeil for the defendants. Along with me today are Jeremy Lewin and Doug Oldham from our firm. In plaintiff's brief to this court, she acknowledges that the University Rank and Tenure Committee is the decision maker in this case. The plaintiff does not accuse any member of that committee of religious bias. Normally, when the plaintiff does not accuse the decision-maker of bias in a Title VII case, the case is over.
Yeah, but, you point out several times in your brief that certain witnesses denied making statements that other witnesses testified were made. For example, Ms. Gulley testified, when she testified, she denied referring to Dr. Reyes as a liberal union-oriented Jew. But Hartwig testified to hearing that comment. How is your argument appropriate under summary judgment standards? Because, for instance, that is a classic credibility issue for a jury, isn't it?
And we make no argument that the testimony should be ignored. I think at trial it's possible that the comment was so old that it might not be admitted. But for purposes of summary judgment, we acknowledge that the court...
I missed what you said.
For purposes of summary
judgment... No, at trial...
Oh, at trial, the comment might be excluded because it's so old and its relevancy depends upon...
Well, it's not 10 years old. It's not 8 years old.
It's not five years old. For purposes of summary judgment, we, along with the court, assume that the comment was made. The reason that it's mentioned in the record that the defendant denies it is so that the record is complete. On summary judgment, what the court has to do is to determine whether or not the plaintiff has produced sufficient evidence to sustain a reasonable jury verdict in light of the entire record. So that while we mention Gulley's denial, we make no argument based on that. And there's, I think, one other case with regard to Professor Chishti, where we disagree that the comment allegedly made by him was made. That's for purposes of making sure that the record is complete and accurate. But we agree that issues of fact that involve credibility determinations are not decided at this stage of the case. By the same token, the court does consider the undisputed facts in the record. Plaintiff's approach in her briefs essentially is to look at her own facts, whereas we believe that as this court and the Supreme Court have said often, that the summary judgment procedure is analogous to the directed verdict procedure, what's now called judgment as a matter of law, where the court sits back, takes a look at the record and says, on this record, the plaintiff can go to the jury or cannot. And our argument here is that on this record, plaintiff falls well short of having sufficient evidence to sustain either of her claims before a reasonable jury.
Well, tell me this, sir. Did you waive the issues surrounding the prima facie case by essentially conceding them and instead focusing of pretext? I mean, where in the record did you preserve the issue of whether Dr. Reyes could make out a prima facie case?
Well, as Judge Sykes pointed out, it's not our burden to produce evidence with regard to that. It's sufficient under Salatek's Court versus Catrett that we simply point out, as we did in our motion for summary judgment, that there is no genuine issue of material fact as to the ultimate issue in this case. That shifts the burden to the plaintiff then to come forward to the court with sufficient evidence to sustain her burden. If she chooses to follow the indirect method of proof, she has to include, pursuant to many of this court's cases, she has to include evidence with regard to the prima facie case. She didn't do that. The judge said that there was no evidence with regard to the issue of whether Professor Falahi was similarly situated. If you look at the 20 paragraphs to which she cites in her brief, they don't address the similarly situated issue. They simply include negative comments about Professor Falahi, which plaintiff says show that she wasn't as good a candidate for tenure as the plaintiff believes she was. So the court did properly reach that issue. We cut to the chase in our brief in the trial court, as we do here today, by saying that there is no evidence to sustain a reasonable jury verdict. It's not necessary for this court to go through a step-by-step analysis either. What the cases say is that the court may jump to the final stage when that's appropriate, and this is a case in which it is. By the same token, the plaintiff, if she chose to follow the indirect method of proof in the trial court, had to address each of its elements, and Judge Duyagi improperly found that she did not with regard to the prima facie case. Essentially, plaintiff's claim of entitlement to a trial rests primarily on four pieces of evidence. There is the Professor Hardwick testimony that 4 years earlier this comment was made. There's former Vice President of Academic Affairs Chalopul's testimony that he and Dean Gulley discussed plaintiff's absence from a campus event because it fell on a Jewish holiday. And there were several questions about that. The fact of the matter is that there is evidence in the record as to one missed event. There is no link or no connection between the discussion of this missed event and the tenure recommendation. Tenure recommendation talks about not being on campus to participate in committee and school functions. It has nothing to do with this missed event. This was a situation where someone was getting an award. It was a student of Professor Reyes, and the conversation went along these lines. Where's Professor Reyes? She's not here because it's Passover. That was it. It was not in any way related to the discussion of tenure, and the implication that it was finds no support in the record. The next piece of evidence the plaintiff points to is Vice President Chalopul's testimony that he, not the University Ranking Tenure Committee, but that Vice President Chalopul defers to the dean's recommendation when he makes a tenure recommendation. First of all, plaintiff offered no admissible evidence to rebut the sworn testimony of all seven of the committee members and the president of the university, who ultimately can veto the committee's decision, that they performed their own independent evaluations of Reyes' qualifications and were not influenced by Gulley's recommendation. Chalopul said, and I'm quoting now, "My decision was influenced by other decisions that were made prior to getting to me, primarily the dean's decision. I defer to deans because the deans are the ones that actually are responsible for building their own schools." Chalopul was the vice president of academic affairs. He is the dean's supervisor, an administrator, and he's in a position where deferring to the dean's recommendation would make sense from an organizational standpoint. The University Rank and Tenure Committee is composed of faculty members, and neither the plaintiff nor Vice President Chalopul has articulated any reason why they would defer to a dean. So he was saying, this is the way I look at it. I'm the vice president. I'm going to defer to my deans. That has nothing at all to do with the decision-making process at the University Rank and Tenure Committee. At that level, all seven members of the committee testified that Dean Gulley's recommendation had nothing to do with their own evaluation. To the contrary, they all said that they independently evaluated the qualifications of Professor Reyes.
Did they also do the same for the
Professor Falahi? Yes. Let me just quote a couple of points that they made in their affidavits. The president, first of all, I very carefully reviewed all of the materials I received regarding Reyes's application for tenure. I made an independent evaluation of Reyes's qualifications and did not simply follow the recommendations of any person or committee. My decision to deny Reyes's application for tenure was the result of my independent analysis of her qualifications and was not based upon the recommendation of Dean Beverly Gulley or any other person or committee. I fully considered both the majority and minority portions of the report prepared for the formal hearing committee regarding Sharon Reyes's grievance before I concluded that the decision of the University Rank and Tenure Committee should stand. The chair of the committee. The committee absolutely does not have to follow the dean's recommendation, and we did not simply follow Dean Beverly Gulley's recommendation regarding Reyes's application for tenure. Instead, the committee members considered all of the documentation received regarding each application for tenure. This included student evaluations, internal and external recommendations, and all of the materials contained in the applicant's dossier. We considered all these elements in our deliberations. We weighed all of the evidence. That is always what is done, and that was what was done in Reyes's case. Each member of the committee reviewed the materials independently, and then we had lengthy meetings to discuss each applicant, including Reyes. The wording of the recommendation letter we composed regarding Reyes was approved by all members of the committee and represented the committee's independent evaluation of Reyes's application for tenure. Now, the interesting thing, of course, about that letter from the committee to the president was that in making the recommendation, the committee differed from Dean Gulley on all three criteria. In order to find liability on the university's part here, this court has to find that the committee was Dean Gulley's cat's paw, that the committee was simply rubber stamping her decision. Well, first of all, with seven affidavits and one deposition to the contrary, there's no evidence to rebut that sworn testimony. Secondly, if we're talking about a rubber stamp here, then why does the committee differ from Dean Gulley on each of the criteria? Dean Gulley said that Professor Reyes's teaching was good. The committee said it was fair. She said that the scholarship was very good. The committee said it was good. So in those two categories, they actually ranked Professor Reyes lower than Dean Gulley had done in her recommendation. With regard to service to the university, they actually gave her a higher rating, rating her good as opposed to fair. The only point as to which they concurred was the point that she was not entitled to tenure because she was not likely to contribute substantially to the intellectual life of the university. Counsel in her brief suggests that this court in the Lust case embraced two cases from other circuits that take a different point of view. The point of view of this circuit is that when we have a situation like this, where there's no allegation of bias against the ultimate decision maker, but instead an allegation of bias earlier on in the recommendation procedure, this court has held that when the causal relationship, inserting the facts of this case, when the causal relationship between Gulley's alleged illicit motive and the university's ultimate decision is broken, and the ultimate decision is clearly made on an independent and a legally permissive basis, the alleged bias of Gulley is not relevant, quoting from the Willis case at 547. Counsel relies on a case from the Ninth Circuit and from the Third Circuit in which courts said that evidence of discrimination earlier in the process would be sufficient. But even those cases are distinguishable on their facts. The Lamb case was a hiring case. There is evidence that allegedly biased faculty members were involved throughout the hiring process. Well, if there was evidence here that Dean Gulley was involved throughout the entire tenure process, this would be Lamb. She was not involved. Once she sent her recommendation on, that was it. The Roebuck case, quote, it is uncontroverted that at each stage of the process, the evaluator had available and considered, and that emphasis is in the court's opinion, and considered the reports and recommendations of each previous evaluator, including the evaluator that allegedly was biased. So, and then counsel in her reply brief says, Lust has embraced Lamb and Roebuck, the Ninth and Third Circuit cases. The court did nothing of the kind. To the contrary, the court cites Willis favorably, the case upon which we rely. The holding of the Lust case is that an employer is liable if it would not have taken the adverse action but for the biased recommendation. Here again, there's a break in the link between the recommendation of Dean Gulley and the ultimate decision of the university. And it's, of course, the university that is accused of religious bias. Dean Gulley cannot be held liable under Title VII. Realizing that, the plaintiffs filed a tortious interference case. As Judge Robner pointed out, her tortious interference claim is precluded by the Human Rights Act if she ascribes to Dean Gulley religious bias. If it's a religious bias claim, it's precluded. So she says, well, as to this claim, maybe there was some other motive. Problem being, she doesn't ever identify what this other motive was. She talks about a feud, and she talks about politicization of the process. Well, those of you that have been on college campuses know that feuds and politicization of the process can very well involve fights over the way the school should be run and other issues that are within the...
I understand that just from walking onto a college campus.
That's right. So the notion that because there was a feud, there therefore was some improper motive on behalf of Dean Gulley is simply wrong. The fact of the matter is that there is a privilege under Illinois law. There has to be a privilege that protects someone in Dean Gulley's position from being hauled into court for writing down her honest opinion. And to get around that privilege, what the plaintiff has to show is an improper motive, a motive that is not in the best interest of the university, and counsel never, or rather the plaintiff has never identified as such a motive in this case. If there are no other questions, I'll ask the court to affirm the decision of the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. McNeil. Anything further, Ms. Pfeiffer?
Just want to make a few additional comments with respect to the comments made by counsel this morning. This case is about the fact that the district court ignored evidence. The district court did not cite to, acknowledge, or even reference one single piece of evidence that Dr. Reyes submitted in corroboration of her claim that Dean Gulley held animosity against her and that there was evidence of both religious discrimination or in the alternative of discrimination, tortious interference. The defendants rely in their brief on several pieces of information and argue that inference ought to be drawn in their favor, and that's not the rule of this court or the role of Judge Dryagian on summary judgment. We've already discussed that VPAA Chaloku indicated he was not going to recommend that Dr. Reyes receive tenure. Dr. Chaloku testified very specifically that the dean's recommendation on tenure is very crucial to the tenure process and is given deference. It was not his opinion. The question that he was asked at deposition was, explain how this works. And his explanation was, the recommendation of the dean is critical. The dean is the one who builds the department, and it's her recommendation that's relied upon. The next question that was asked at deposition was, was this your experience at St. Xavier? And he testified in the affirmative that it was, in fact, his experience at St. Xavier. The defendants, again, asked this court to draw an inference in its favor with the testimony that Dr. Reyes' testimony in her affidavit, that Dr. Kiste specifically told her that her application for tenure had garnered considerable, extremely emotional debate and was so contentious because of the dean's negative recommendation.
Thank you, Ms. Pfeiffer.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.